Part 6. The Giza Invitation. Egypt, Section 1. Chapter 33. Cardinal Points. Giza, Egypt, 16th of March 1993, 3:30 a.m. We walked through the deserted lobby of our hotel and stepped into the white Fiat waiting for us in the driveway outside. It was driven by a lean, nervous Egyptian named Ali, whose job it was to get us past the guards at the Great Pyramid and away again before sunrise. He was nervous, because if things went wrong, Santha and I would be deported from Egypt and he would go to jail for 6 months. Of course, things were not supposed to go wrong. That was why Ali was with us. The day before, we'd paid him $150, which he had changed into Egyptian pounds and spread among the guards concerned. They, in return, had agreed to turn a blind eye to our presence during the next couple of hours. We drove to within half a mile of the pyramid, then walked the rest of the way, around the side of the steep embankment that looms above the village of Nazlat al-Saman and leads to the monument's north face. None of us said very much as we trudged through the soft sand just out of range of the security lights. We felt excited and apprehensive at the same time. Ali was by no means certain that his bribes were going to work. For a while, we stood still in the shadows, gazing at the monstrous bulk of the pyramid, reaching into the darkness above us and blotting out the southern stars. Then a patrol of three men armed with shotguns and wrapped in blankets against the night chill came into view at the northeastern corner, about 50 yards away, where they stopped to share a cigarette. Indicating that we should stay put, Ali stepped forward into the light and walked over to the guards. He talked to them for several minutes, apparently arguing heatedly. Finally, he beckoned to us, indicating that we should join him. "There's a problem," he explained. "One of them, the captain here," he indicated a short, unshaven, disgruntled-looking fellow, "is insisting that we pay an extra $30, otherwise the deal is off. What do you want to do?" I fished around in my wallet, counted out $30, and handed the bills to Ali. He folded them and passed them to the captain. With an air of aggrieved dignity, the captain stuffed the money into his shirt pocket, and finally we all shook hands. "Okay," said Ali, "let's go." Inexplicable precision. As the guards continued their patrol in a westerly direction along the northern face of the Great Pyramid, we made our way around the northeastern corner and along the base of the eastern face. I had long ago fallen into the habit of orienting myself according to the monument's sides. The northern face was aligned almost perfectly to true north, the eastern face almost perfectly to true east, the southern to true south, and the western face to true west. The average error was only around 3 minutes of arc, down to less than 2 minutes on the southern face. Incredible accuracy for any building in any epoch, and an inexplicable, almost supernatural feat here in Egypt 4,500 years ago, when the Great Pyramid was supposed to have been built. An error of 3 arc minutes represents an infinitesimal deviation from true of less than 0.015%. In the opinion of structural engineers with whom I had discussed the Great Pyramid, the need for such precision was impossible to understand. From their point of view, as practical builders, the expense, difficulty, and time spent achieving it would not have been justified by the apparent results, even if the base of the monument had been as much as 2 or 3 degrees out of true, an error of, say, 1%, the difference to the naked eye would still have been too small to be noticeable. On the other hand, the difference in the magnitude of the tasks required to achieve accuracy within 3 minutes as opposed to 3 degrees would have been immense. Obviously, therefore, the ancient master builders who had raised the pyramid at the very dawn of human civilization must have had powerful motives for wanting to get the alignments with the cardinal directions just right. Moreover, since they had achieved their objective with uncanny exactness, they must have been highly skilled, knowledgeable, and competent people with access to excellent surveying and setting out equipment. This impression was confirmed by many of the monument's other characteristics. For example, its sides at the base were all almost exactly the same length, demonstrating a margin of error far smaller than modern architects would be required to achieve today in the construction of, say, an average-sized office block. This was no office block, however. It was the Great Pyramid of Egypt, one of the largest structures ever built by man, and one of the oldest. Its north side was 755 feet, 4.9818 inches in length. Its west side was 755 feet, 9.1551 inches in length. Its east side was 755 feet, 10.4937 inches. Its south side, 756 feet, 0.9739 inches. This meant that there was a difference of less than 8 inches between its shortest and longest sides, an error amounting to a tiny fraction of 1% on an average side length of over 9,063 inches. Once again, I knew from an engineering perspective that the bare figures did not do justice to the enormous care and skill required to achieve them. I knew, too, that scholars had not yet come up with a convincing explanation of exactly how the pyramid builders had adhered consistently to such high standards of precision. What really interested me, however, was the even bigger question mark over another issue. Why had they imposed such exacting standards on themselves? If they had permitted a margin of error of 1 to 2% instead of less than 0.1%, they could have simplified their tasks with no apparent loss of quality. Why hadn't they done so? Why had they insisted on making everything so difficult? Why, in short, in a supposedly primitive stone monument built more than 4,500 years ago, were we seeing this strange, obsessional adherence to machine-age standards of precision? Black hole in history. Our plan was to climb the Great Pyramid, something that had been strictly illegal since 1983, when the messy falls of several foolhardy tourists had forced the government of Egypt to impose a ban. I realized that we were being foolhardy too, particularly in attempting the climb at night, and I didn't feel good about breaking what was basically a sensible law. By this stage, however, my intense interest in the pyramid and my desire to learn everything I could about it had overridden my common sense. Now, after parting company with the guard patrol at the northeastern corner of the monument, we continued to make our way surreptitiously along the eastern face towards the southeastern corner. There were dense shadows among the twisted and broken paving stones that separated the Great Pyramid from the three much smaller subsidiary pyramids lying immediately to its east. There were also three deep and narrow rock-cut pits which resembled giant graves. These had been found empty by the archaeologists who had excavated them, but were shaped as though they had been intended to enclose the hulls of high-prowed, streamlined boats. Roughly halfway along the pyramid's eastern face, we encountered another patrol. This time it consisted of two guards, one of whom must have been 80 years old. His companion, a teenager with pustulant acne, informed us that the money Ali had paid was insufficient and that 50 more Egyptian pounds would be required if we were to proceed. I already had the notes in my hand and gave them to the lad without delay. I was past caring how much this was costing. I just wanted to make the climb and get down and away before dawn without being arrested. We walked on, reaching the southeastern corner at a little after 4:15 a.m. Very few modern buildings, even the houses we live in, have corners that consist of perfect 90-degree right angles. It is common for them to be a degree or more out of true. It doesn't make any difference structurally, and nobody notices such minute errors. In the case of the Great Pyramid, however, I knew that the ancient master builders had found a way to narrow the margin of error to almost nothing. Thus, while falling short of the perfect 90 degrees, the southeastern corner achieved an impressive 89 degrees, 56 minutes, 27 seconds. The northeastern corner measured 90 degrees, 3 minutes, 2 seconds. The southwestern, 90 degrees, 0 minutes, 33 seconds. And the northwestern was just 2 seconds of a degree out of true at 89 degrees, 59 minutes, 58 seconds. This was, of course, extraordinary. And like almost everything else about the Great Pyramid, it was also extremely difficult to explain. Such accurate building techniques, as accurate as the best we have today, could have evolved only after thousands of years of development and experimentation. Yet there was no evidence that any process of this kind had ever taken place in Egypt. The Great Pyramid and its neighbors at Giza had emerged out of a black hole in architectural history so deep and so wide that neither its bottom nor its far side had ever been identified. Ships in the desert. Guided by the increasingly perspiring Ali, who had not yet explained why it was necessary for us to circumnavigate the pyramid before climbing it, we now began to make our way in a westerly direction along the monument's southern side. Here there were two further boat-shaped pits, one of which, though still sealed, had been investigated with fiber-optic cameras and was known to contain a high-prowed, sea-going vessel more than 100 feet long. The other pit had been excavated in the 1950s. Its contents, an even larger sea-going vessel, a full 141 feet in length, had been placed in the so-called Boat Museum, an ugly, modern structure that gangled on stilts beneath the south face of the Great Pyramid. Made of cedar wood, the beautiful ship in the museum was still in perfect condition 4,500 years after it had been built. With a displacement of around 40 tons, its design was particularly thought-provoking, incorporating, in the words of one expert, all the seagoing ship's characteristic properties, with prow and stern soaring upward, higher than in a Viking ship, to ride out the breakers and high seas, not to contend with the little ripples of the Nile. Another authority felt that the careful and clever design of this strange pyramid boat could potentially have made it a far more seaworthy craft than anything available to Columbus. Moreover, the experts agreed that it had been built to a pattern that could only have been created by shipbuilders from a people with a long, solid tradition of sailing on the open sea. Present at the very beginning of Egypt's 3,000-year history, who had those as yet unidentified shipbuilders been? They had not accumulated their long, solid tradition of sailing on the open sea while ploughing the fields of the landlocked Nile Valley. So where and when had they developed their maritime skills? There was yet another puzzle. I knew that the ancient Egyptians had been very good at making scale models and representations of all manner of things for symbolic purposes. I therefore found it hard to understand why they would have gone to the trouble of manufacturing and then burying a boat as big and sophisticated as this if its only function, as the Egyptologists claimed, had been as a token of the spiritual vessel that would carry the soul of the deceased king to heaven. That could have been achieved as effectively with a much smaller craft, and only one would have been needed, not several. Logic therefore suggested that these gigantic vessels might have been intended for some other purpose altogether, or had some quite different and still unsuspected symbolic significance. We had reached the rough midpoint of the southern face of the Great Pyramid, when we at last realized why we were being taken on this long walkabout. The objective was for us to be relieved of moderate sums of money at each of the four cardinal points. The tally thus far was $30 US at the northern face and £50 Egyptian at the eastern face. Now I shelled out a further £50 Egyptian to yet another patrol Ali was supposed to have paid off the day before. "Ali," I hissed, "when are we going to climb the pyramid?" "Right away, Mr. Graham," our guide replied. He walked confidently forward, gesturing directly ahead, then added, "We shall ascend at the southwest corner."